From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Should students be allowed to choose their own grades?
Grade me. Look at me. Evaluate and rank me. Oh, I'm good, 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 and oh, so smart. Grade me!
A UGA professor thinks that might be a good idea. We'll hear what the Break Room Gang thinks this hour. First, though, yesterday we talked with the creator of the cult classic TV show Mystery Science Theater 3000.
If I'm sitting next to somebody on a plane and the conversation goes to what I do, I tend to bring out my sketchbook and I'll draw a picture of a movie screen and little theater seats with three characters, a man and two robots, that talk during the movie. And most people, when they see that, they'll go, oh, right, that.
That's MST3K creator Joel Hodgson. We asked, what are your favorite bad movies? Here are your first thoughts.
This is Ryan Hutto calling from Columbus, Georgia, and I want to tell you about the worst film I've ever seen in my life. It's called The Black Devil Doll from Hell. It's a blaxploitation flick with, I guess, about a $35 budget, and it uses a Casio keyboard for the score.
Daniel Sanchez Torres tweets to us about this movie.
This vicious plant can be grown in your neighbor's yard, rolled into harmless-looking cigarettes.
That's from Reefer Madness, the 1936 anti-marijuana film. And I stick, of course, with the classic Plan 9 from Outer Space. And we also heard from Daniel, who says, Latter Days is terrible, but it was the first explicitly gay movie I ever watched, and I'm obsessed with complaining about it. We always love to get your thoughts. You know how to reach us. You can find us on social media or just call and leave a message. The number's 404-500-9457. Remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Colin Mochrie may have one of the fastest minds around. The comedian is best known for his role on Whose Line Is It Anyway? And audiences in Atlanta can see him live tonight and tomorrow at Dad's Garage. Colin joins me in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
When did you first suspect you might be good at improv? Like, when did you first think, hey, this is my niche?
Oh, well, there wasn't a time. When I was growing up, it didn't exist. So it wasn't until I first saw improv, some friends were demonstrating it. I thought, oh, this will be interesting to try out. You don't really have to learn anything. You just make up crap. I can do that. And I took a workshop and found that I really had an affinity for it. And so it just became something I loved doing. And I never thought, oh, this is going to be my career. So it's really worked out nicely for me.
I mean, obviously, you have to practice and rehearse improv quite a lot, which seems antithetical, but it's not. But do you think an improvisation pro is born or made?
Oh, well, I think anyone can do improv. I mean, all our lives are improvised. So basically, the two rules are doing the things that we don't do in real life, which is listening and accepting other people's ideas. That is the hardest hurdle for new improvisers to get over. There's that thing, and that's where, no, my idea is better. And once you learn to let that go, you can be a good improviser. I think the humor aspect, I think you're born with it. I don't think anyone, classes could make you funnier. They can't make you funny. You have to have that, I think, to begin with.
Let's hear from the late comic Del Close. He's often called the father of long-form improv. He played a big role in forming Second City. Here he is speaking in 1970. He's talking to the legendary journalist Studs Terkel and explaining why he thinks improv is more than just sketch comedy.
The theater of psychology, the theater of feeling, is very much on the way out. And it's only through action that we understand someone, not through what they tell us about themselves. No soliloquy is going to reveal nearly so much about what the guy does as what he does after the soliloquy, what the guy's like, rather. And that's what I'm trying to get to in improvisation as well.
So how do you, when you're practicing improv, how do you balance the verbal, what you're saying, and you're so good at the one-liners, right, mm-hmm. with the physicality that he's talking about?
You know, it all depends on the scene. You know, I don't really practice improv. What I do is try to get to a state where I'm just totally relaxed on walking out onto a stage in front of an audience who have paid good money to see a show that I don't have at that moment. So you're open to everything that comes along. And then your body and mind go into sort of a survival mode where you start physicalizing. Even the smallest moment can get a laugh and get an audience to go, I know that movement. I know that person. I know that situation. It just becomes an organic thing that you and your partners sort of start to breathe together and make this living scene. It's such a bizarre art form because it truly just lasts for that moment. If you saw someone say, I saw this really funny show last night. The guy walked like a duck. And you go, well, what? You had to be there to see the entire process and why that was funny at that moment. It really is such a, it's like a firefly or something. It just lives for that 2 hours and then it's gone forever.
Although there are people who watch reruns of Whose Line Is It Away endlessly. Here's a pretty popular sketch. One of the sketches that you did numerous times on that show was where you played a news anchor and each time you had a different name. Here are a few of those names.
Welcome to the 6 o'clock news. I'm your anchor, Arthur Any More Donuts. Welcome to the 6 o'clock news. I'm your anchor, Earl from Ipanema. Welcome to the 6 o'clock news. I'm your anchor, Wolverine St. Jack John. Welcome to the 6 o'clock news. I'm your anchor, Lars of the Red Hot Lovers.
You shook your head.
It's just sad when you hear them all in a row. Oh, the career's gone now.
Just joining me, I'm speaking with comedian Colin Mockery, who's performing tonight and tomorrow at Dad's Garage. I mean, do you often go back and listen to improvisation or sketches that you've done?
No. There are times where I'll be, clicking channels and I'll see a Whose Line and watch it. And it's I'm watching as an audience because I have no memory of that particular scene. The only one, and now I don't know if I know it because I remember, or I've just seen it so many times, is the Richard Simmons scene where I use him as a jet ski that... Yet to be there.
Well, actually, we have a little clip of that also. We first hear Drew Carey introducing everyone.
Let's continue the show with a game called, I love this game, Living Scenery. This is for Ryan, Colin, and Wayne. And Richard Simmons, everybody. Richard Simmons. Ryan and Colin are going to act out a scene. During the scene, they have to use a number of props. However, since they don't have any real props to work with
I'll
tonight.
I'll be the prop.
Right, Wayne and Richard.
He was so committed.
Yes.
You've got to love that.
What makes a good partner in improv? I mean, you've already said somebody who listens and responds, right? Mm-hmm. Is that basically all that you need?
That's it. And trust, someone that you totally trust. You know, I work with Ryan Stiles a lot, and I tour with Brad Sherwood. Both those guys, I usually know where they're going to go in a scene. But when I don't, I trust them both enough to just follow along and see what's going to happen. So trust is a big part.
So when you're doing improv, I mean, improv, I assume, is a relative, based on whatever shows I've been to, they seem to be a relatively diverse crowd of, mm-hmm. of people. And I wonder how you deal then with controversial subjects or if you steer away from them. It's hard these days because almost everything becomes political, right?
Yeah.
But do you hesitate before you bring up a joke or a line that might be controversial?
We try. Brad Sherwood and I have been touring for 15 years. And lately, we've actually started off the show saying, we would like to keep this a political-free show. We're just doing goofy stuff. So please, let's not mention just the current events. Because I don't know in an improv setting, we can... bring justice to what the suggestion is. You know, there are so many great satirical, political satirists out there who can make a point. Our thing would be, well, this is stupid. And then it'd be hard to sort of build on that. And it's not what we do. We're just there to have goofy fun. We throw little things out. But we started to notice during the Bush administration, there was one night Brad made a totally innocuous Bush joke, and the audience was immediately divided in half. And it was like, wow, how did this happen? Americans love making fun of their presidents. And it's just gotten actually worse since then. So we made this choice, just let's keep away from it. It's not what our show is mainly about. And it's really not worth it for that one little moment to suddenly split up our audience.
And that's very different. That's a clear dividing line between how vocal you may or may not be in your personal life as opposed to what you do on stage. And That's especially true. You've been quite public in support of your transgender daughter. In January, you tweeted, quote, "My 90-year-old mother-in-law and 87-year-old mother love and acceptance of our trans daughter warms me. Wonder why some who are younger can't," end quote. So here's an actual comment from the CBC, an interview of your daughter, Kinley, talking about her transition.
I had come out to my mom. My dad was out of town, and it was a lot of conversations, getting all the information, making sure we were on even playing field. It took some time, but I knew that support and acceptance was on the other side. I was not worried for a second.
How do you separate those kind of things? And obviously, transgender issues are very much in the political and public eye, extremely controversial. So how do you successfully keep those separate?
It's just something I've done. I've always sort of kept my professional and private life separate. I mean, except for the fact that I'm known from television, I think people would be surprised if they didn't know me that I was in the entertainment business, because I'm very quiet. I'm very shy. I tend to listen more than actually start conversations. So I always kept those two things. My wife calls the guy on Whose Line the other, because it is nothing like the man she has married, which is great, because I think that would be very tiring to be married to someone who is on all the time. So that's a totally separate issue. And my private life, transgender politics is something I've obviously become involved in lately because of personal experience. And just, you know, it's 2017. I've missed a year. I really feel we should be in the Star Trek part of our life, where everyone has gotten together, we're all doing fine, and now we're heading off into find other worlds to screw up and keep this one good. I think it's ridiculous that we still have to work on gender and race and sexual politics at this time where we have so much information. Maybe we have too much information. It's hard for people to sort of figure out what the truth is and what is just stuff that's thrown out there. So when I do talk about it, it is from my personal life, and something I feel very passionate about. And, you know, I'm not going to change a lot of people's perceptions about this, but if I can get a conversation starting, you know, that's a beginning.
In the 30 seconds that we have left, what is the role then for comedy in a time when even a joke divides people?
I think people like Stephen Colbert and Seth Meyers and John Oliver, we need those guys, because they're showing the idiocy of the world, of the government, of the people who are in power, and we need that to sort of keep them honest as much as we can. You know, I don't think a comedy show can completely save the world, but it can get people thinking and get them out there and make them want a better world, a world where we can laugh maybe about other things at some point, where, you know, the biggest joke will be about a puppy.
That is comedian Colin Mochrie. He performs tonight and tomorrow night at Dad's Garage in Atlanta. You can get more details and watch some of Colin's past performances at gpbnews.org. Such a pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Just ahead, should college students be able to choose their own grades? And should atheists care if people think they're bad? The Breakroom Gang weighs in. First, we'll add two more songs to the George playlist. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Let's add a couple more tunes to our Georgia playlist. For this, we ask people to choose two songs they think best represent Georgia. Two simple rules: nominations have to be songs written or performed by a Georgian, and artists can't nominate one of their own songs. Today, we feature the Athens band Shehehe. They release a new album called Endless Summer this weekend. Drummer and singer Jason Fusco brings us his picks for the Georgia playlist.
Hi, my name is Jason Fusco. I'm a drummer for a local band called Shehehe.
I'll send you a picture to show you.
My first pick for the Georgia playlist is a song by The Glands called Living Way Easy. Man, it's just, it pretty much describes what it's like to be in Athens or anywhere on a perfect day. What it's about really means a lot to me, too. It's kind of complicating your life and wishing it was simple again, you know? Sometimes it's just many simple things that complicate your life, but wanting to go back to either a place or a time where, you know, you were content, but you didn't realize it then and until later when things are just a little more convoluted and unclear. This song in particular has a vibe, a little Pixies-ish, I guess. It has a push and pull and kind of a warpy, like, background going on the whole time. And it goes well with his voice. Georgia's definitely, you know, part of the South. You can hear it in his voice. You can hear, like, a little bit of twang, but it's still very rock and roll. And the hazily happy, I guess, would be my best way to describe it. The Glands have influenced me and changed my songwriting process from just the way that Ross Shapiro, the singer, manipulates his voice can make like a word go for a little longer than it normally would in conversation to fit the music, and to me that's beautiful, and I try to do that. The drums are great. They inspire me. They sound so good on recording. Tasteful, and there's only fills when they need to be there, but the whole thing has a flow and a bounce. My second pick for the Georgia playlist is Illegal Drugs, a band from Atlanta. The song is called Just Like You. Of course, growing up in the 80s, 90s, huge Nirvana fan. It starts with a really great drum roll, and then kind of has like a pounding hypnotic quality until it gets to the chorus, and then it opens up into like these major beautiful vocals. And then it drops back down, so it has like, and it makes you wait. It does like a short chorus the first time, and then makes you wait for the big chorus the second time. And it's one of those really like melodic but heavy rock songs, which is, I like all kinds of music from jazz to country, but I feel like melodic heavy rock is my favorite, where there's just great vocals and a super driving bass and drums and guitar. Just like you, just like you. The delivery is a little like, it's a little southern and deliberate. It would be like if Paul Westerberg, from The Replacements was from maybe Augusta or Macon or something instead of from Minneapolis, and My favorite songs are kind of like bittersweet love songs. So I think maybe it's like two people feeling like they're alone and then bonding over that. Not necessarily getting together because of it, but experiencing that loneliness together and taking comfort in that, you know. That's what I think the song's about.
That was Jason Fusco of the Athens band Shihihi. They have a record release show at the 40 Watt in Athens this Saturday at 9 p.m. It has been a long week. We talked about the Dixie Mafia. We heard some guerrilla mating calls. So as we do every Friday, it's time to sit down with some smart people, kick back, unwind, and think about what the heck happened this week. It's time for the break room.
So are you going to get another job?
I don't think I'd like another job.
Well, what are you going to do about money and bills? And
you know, I've never really liked paying bills. I don't think I'm going to do that either.
I've never gotten a B before. I feel so dirty.
All right, listen, I need some cash.
What for?
I just need it, that's all.
Oh, no. Don't tell me. You're gambling again, aren't you?
Joining us in the break room, Sumaya Khalifa is Executive Director of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta. Christian Zilovitz is Director of Community Outreach for the Pride School Atlanta. Amy Condon is in Savannah. She's a freelance writer and founder of the Refinery Writing Studio. And we have Steve Brown, Commissioner for the Fayette County Board of Commissioners. Welcome to Friday, everyone.
All right. Welcome.
Yay. Yay, glad to be here.
Okay, so let's talk about work. We all know what happened. Look, it's a cautionary tale in pretty much every movie. We know what happens when you start putting technology into people.
Now, don't take this the wrong way, but you are a Terminator, right?
Yes. Cyberdyne Systems Model 101. I'm a cybernetic organism, living tissue over a metal endoskeleton.
All right. We haven't gone quite that far, but a Wisconsin company plans to put microchips into its employees' hands in order to replace ID cards. For right now, the program is voluntary. The question is, would you do this?
I think it's the beginning of the end, Celeste. I mean, here we go. I mean, they can already track me everywhere I go with my cell phone.
Right.
Now they're going to just embed the chip and make it permanent, you know? So I can't put the cell phone down and walk away. Now they're going to follow me wherever I go.
You know, this is really funny because I belong to a store where you have to show your ID. And I always thought, gosh, if I they had a chip in me, I don't have to get my ID out. So when I read this story, I said, oh, my gosh. But I think it's really the wave of the future, whether we like it or not. We don't like it now, but in 10 years from now, that'll probably be the norm. I'm worried about the invasiveness of it, though.
Amy, what do you think? Yeah.
I feel like we're going to be barcoded and be, you know, commodities. So I know I wouldn't volunteer to do it, but that I have a really strong anti-authoritarian streak. So it would make me uncomfortable. I don't want people to be able to track me when I'm not at work, and that become some way that they think that I'm now available 24/7.
Christian, is this all that much different than like iris scanners or fingerprint scanners at the airport?
You know, I know they have like the thumbprint scanners and stuff like that for employees in a lot of different places now. But you actually have to physically be there. And I think the ability to track somebody and gather information that just because they're saying they're gathering this information today, it doesn't mean they can't just change the program in the background and do, you know, different things. The other thing is putting something in your body just because you work somewhere, as I think you don't know what the risks are in the long run. And if people
makes it way harder to walk out in a huff, right?
Yeah. And because if they're not, what are they going to do? Rip it out of you or something? Yeah. They're going to disable you?
Or go interview with somebody else.
Right. I quit. Wait, can you dig this thing out of my hand?
How do you get it removed?
Well, we would love to hear from listeners. Would you get a microchip embedded into your skin? Let us know. You can call us at 404-500-9457 or just tweet us. It's at OST Talk. All right. Speaking of leaving work, a Google engineer recently sparked a great deal of outrage and then ended up getting fired. That's because he released a letter that said more women are not in tech because men are biologically better at it.
James Damore told us he was booted from Google's campus in Mountain View, California at 5 o'clock yesterday. The software engineer told CBS News via email he was wrongfully terminated for perpetuating gender stereotypes and said his three-year career at Google ended for political reasons.
Yay. Okay, so did you just say yay?
Yay.
Three. He made it
good
3 years.
Congratulations.
Wait, did you say good riddance? Wait, is everyone cheering for this guy's firing?
You know what? Yes. Let me take a different approach. I actually went and read the paper.
Yeah.
It's 10 pages.
Yes.
Unfortunately, the news is taking one sentence out of 10 pages, and they're kind of playing the
biological part. Oh, no, there were more sentences than that.
Well, how did he have time to write 10 pages? There were some very thought-provoking pieces in there. I thought that there, when he was talking about the diversity programs within Google and are we doing it right, and he didn't say he was against having diversity in the workplace. And he didn't necessarily say he was against women being in higher places. That's actually in the document where he says that's all right. But he was bringing up some points. I thought it would be a fascinating discussion piece for the corporate world, for universities and stuff like that, just to start a dialogue.
What are you talking about?
I think
what kind of dialogue would they have, whether women are as good as men or not?
No, I mean, what he's talking about is really this whole paper is based on the diversity program at Google. The women and men thing just kind of
right, but
was
he
an
basically he says it's been scientifically proven that women are more nervous neurotic and
I'm not
emotional.
Saying he's 100% correct, Celeste, but I'm just saying it's a thought provoking.
Your daughter's here. Be careful.
That's right.
But it's a thought provoking piece. I thought it would be a good discussion starter for some of it because the diversity program within Google is under fire. From a lot of circles now, and he's actually discussing
mostly
some of those
things. Mostly because it's almost all men. Good point.
Right.
Amy, what do you think here? Was the firing justified?
Well, one, I sort of was going, how did he have time to write a 10-page memo and do his job? But that was one thing. So I was like, is he doing this on his work time? But two, you can raise the issue of exploring a better diversity program without resorting to these sort of lame gender stereotypes, so to speak, and focus on how do you improve a program and what can we do to bring, what can we do at the STEM level in schools to encourage women to stay in and young girls to stay in technology? Are there different ways of approaching it rather than saying that it's been scientifically proven, which I went looking to see if there had been some scientifically proven thing.
Oh, TLDR, no.
Exactly. I was going, if you're going to say that, then cite your source. Because the whole concept that women don't have the capacity or the intellectual curiosity when some of the very first programs that led to the development of Bluetooth, that led to the development of the internet, all were done by women.
Yeah, founded our space program as we all.
Right, their stories aren't told. That's the problem.
It's another good topic for conversation, as Steve said. So you know how to reach us. Give us your thoughts as well. But let's talk about something way more relaxing. National parks. National parks, they're very beautiful. They are also very popular.
How does nobody live right here? This is beautiful land. But this is going to be our view from the breakfast table. Every morning we look out, we see the Grand Canyon. And I mean, we have to be able to get down to the Grand Canyon.
Escalators.
Escalator down. No, big water slides.
National parks are experiencing at this moment a record number of visitors. Now listen, if 2 million people visit the Grand Canyon, that's considered a crowd. Last year's attendance was 6 million. Park staffs have been cut in recent years. They are overwhelmed, and crowds are threatening plants and wildlife. They're going off the path. They're trampling things. So do we think they should limit the number of visitors who can be in a national park at any one time?
Well, you know, the interesting thing was in 2016 was the centennial of the National Park Service.
Yes.
So they did all these promotions begging people to come to the parks. Guess what? It worked. So now they're just
well,
overrun
it's been
with
on the
people.
Rise for like
right.
10 years.
But
yeah.
They've done a lot of promotion to bring people to the parks and try to get them in there. That's working. So now, you know, you're having to deal with the fruits of your success. So
but
I mean,
what
it's
going
to be interesting to see how they play it. But I think you're eventually going to have to ration out the number of people who can go in there because of the wildlife damage that you're doing in some of the areas mm-hmm. where you're actually impacting the environment.
I agree
what
with Steve.
But it hasn't trans... Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry. I agree with what Steve said. I mean, if I want national parks to be available for my children and grandchildren, I want to make sure that we make sure we take care of them right
Check
now.
Them. Amy, you go ahead.
What I was saying is that while the interest in national parks has gone up, the federal funding for
yeah, it's gone down.
The federal funding's gone down and the staffing has gone down.
Yeah.
So you can't actually manage the visitors. And I think part of the push for the more PR around it was that you were going to be more aware of your national parks.
Right. And maybe
and be advocates.
We're loosening some. You had something to say, Christian?
Well, and I think encouraging people to visit their local and state parks and actually paying people a fair wage to even just a fair mm-hmm. wage to
yeah.
work or, you know, more internships to support taking care of the parks. I think, yes, you have to limit just like you limit any other place to make it safe. But there's a lot of encouragement of, you know, minorities visiting national parks.
Right.
And now you're complaining that they're going.
Right. Well, yes.
So
it's Friday. We are hanging out in the break room. And just ahead, we're going to talk about whether the president is to blame for a hostile work environment. First, a look at every college student's dream. This is on Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. We are having some coffee and conversation in the break room. My guests today are Christian Zilovitz of the Pride School Atlanta, Steve Brown, Commissioner for the Fayette County Board of Commissioners, Sumaya Khalifa of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta, and down in Savannah, we've got Amy Condon, a writer and founder of the Refinery Writing Studio. All right, let's jump right in here. Sometimes we don't get the grades that we wanted.
Mrs. Krabappel, in figuring out my final grades, I hope you'll note that all of my textbooks are being returned in excellent condition. In some cases, still in their original wrappings.
A University of Georgia professor wants to adopt a so-called stress reduction policy that would allow students to select their own grades if they, quote, feel unduly stressed by the ones they have earned, unquote. UGA administration says not happening. So what do you think of this policy? Should the professor be allowed to make a rule like this? Is it a good idea?
Well,
let's go with our Pride School.
I'll go with the Pride School. It's funny that they should bring this up at the university level because in the K-12 levels, they are moving towards mastery grading. So did you pass muster on these skills that are required to demonstrate that you know how to do all these things? And many homeschoolers come away with no grades. They come away with a portfolio that shows I've passed muster. And taking away the A and the B and the C that really don't mean a lot to a lot of people, like taking away the GPA and saying, yes, I've demonstrated that I can do these things, but I didn't do extra credit. So, you know, and those situations where you are doing group projects or whatever in colleges with people who have been partying all night and don't have the same priorities, I think it's fine to remove the GPA part because in the long run, did you get your degree? So
that's different than letting a student choose a grade,
right?
Though.
So,
yeah, that's different.
Like,
yeah,
if
yeah.
you're going to have a graded system, if you're going to play the game, you've got to play the game. If you want to go to an ungraded school, you can go to an ungraded school. They
yeah.
actually do exist. So
it's not
it's
UGA.
It's kind of a weird,
yeah, it's odd
concept.
Amy, would you wanted to add something?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Choosing, I agree on the concept of mastering certain skills and abilities. And, you know, sort of passing people along on that. But letting someone choose their grade, I don't think is as wise because I don't know that that reduces stress or just sort of rewards bad behavior, especially like in a group project.
Right.
I teach both non-credit creative writing and college level writing. And there's things that I'm going, well, I can't teach curiosity, but I want to reward curiosity. But a grade doesn't really reward that.
That's a good point.
And, you know, things that are intrinsic to a really good writer.
Yeah.
So that are hard to calculate.
Right. Sumaya, what do you think?
I went to college at the wrong time. I would have picked his class.
Steve?
Well, you know, the stress is incredible because I read about it. The incoming freshman class at the University of Georgia, the GPA is 4.0. So, I mean, the stress has got to be incredible. He probably recognized that they're under tremendous pressure, and you've got the helicopter parents and everything in their high school days. But, hey, it's the real world, and if you want to live in the real world, then you got to have real-world pressures, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're not preparing them.
Okay, so let's talk about gambling. gambling can be very risky, but it can also be very lucrative if you're the house.
How much? $100? $200? $1,000? Hey, wait a second. What are you doing? You're not betting. You know he's not supposed to bet.
Come on, Jerry. It's a lock.
All right. A Cherokee tribe wants to return to its ancestral home in Georgia and build a casino. That would mean the governor could basically leave the legislature out of negotiations almost entirely. Do you want a casino in Georgia? And if so, would you be okay with having this Cherokee tribe build it?
You know, I think this is a sleazy deal. I think it's the casino guys who found a tribe that they could talk into moving back to Georgia and building a casino. They've been trying to do this for years, and the legislature won't allow it to do it. But, you know, I think it's just a shorthanded way of subverting the legislature so they don't have to do that.
I'm all for them reclaiming their land, but the casino part I don't like.
Okay. Amy?
I think it's great that they'd come back and reclaim their land, but they do have to have an income, and I'm wondering, I've seen them, the Indian casinos, be very beneficial to the Seminole and the Miccosukee in South Florida, which also would mean my mother-in-law would come up and visit more often if there were a casino here. So I'm kind of like, I could, you know.
Christian.
I'm of the same mindset that the tribal casinos out in Washington State, where I lived for 16 years, create an income, and gambling is everywhere in the state of Georgia. So whether you have casinos or not, people are gambling. If the pre-K program is based on, you know, funded by the state lottery, which is also largely funded by compulsive gamblers, people are going to gamble wherever they go. But if you can, if the tribe can create some income out of it in healthy ways for anybody, you know, jobs are jobs. I mean, I think people complain more about Walmart creating jobs and building Walmarts than they do about the casinos, and the gambling is still happening all over the place. It's just more invisible right now. People think
right,
it's
you
not
have
happening.
This little, yeah, you have those little strip mall lottery places.
Yeah, it's true.
And
true.
They're all over, you know,
the little
poor
machines.
Neighborhoods.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like the lottery, the money has to go where you say it's going to go. And if they do that, I would love to see how much money the Indian tribe actually gets. Yeah.
It's a fair point. All right, yeah. So let's move on to another particularly southern issue. A woman named Catherine Templeton is running for governor in South Carolina. During a recent town hall forum, she said she is proud of the Confederacy and if elected would never remove Confederate monuments. So the question is this issue important enough for you to base a vote on, or are there other things that sort of take precedence here?
I think she's taking a lesson from the campaign of Sonny Perdue. We had the flag issue here in the state of Georgia. Sonny said, I'm never going to change that flag, got in office, and the flag changed. So I think it's pandering to a specific portion of the population when you need a vote in an election.
Without having to follow through.
You don't have to follow through because it's all politics.
Ugh. Amy, would you pace a vote on this?
I would. That would make me definitely consider not voting for that person because of the pandering. I don't even want to see what they would do when they get in office, because I think she even said something about rewriting history. And I'm going, most of these monuments were established during Reconstruction and Jim Crow era to sort of put people in their place and used as, you know, to rewrite the history of the Confederacy. So I would definitely vote against somebody who used that as a key point.
Sumaya?
I would vote against her. Absolutely.
No.
No, you would not vote against her?
Oh, no, I would vote against her, yeah.
Oh, okay.
It would be a definite nope.
Deal breaker. Okay, so those of you out there listening, is this a deal breaker for you or not? Maybe it makes you more likely. I mean, if she's supposedly pandering, I'm not saying that, but if she is, she's pandering to someone, so maybe it'd make you more likely to vote for her. You can let us know. Tweet us at OST Talk or call us. We are hanging out in the break room with Christian Zilovitz of the Pride School Atlanta, Steve Brown of the Fayette County Board of Commissioners, Sumaya Khalifa of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta, and Amy Condon, a founder of the Refinery writing studio.
I like the refiny.
Refiny in Savannah. All right. Remember comedian George Carlin? He was an outspoken atheist.
Religion has actually convinced people that there's an invisible man living in the sky who watches everything you do every minute of every day. And the invisible man has a special list of 10 things he does not want you to do.
A new study that was conducted widely in 13 different countries shows a lot of people, most people, think that atheists are bad, bad people. The researcher says atheists shouldn't worry about that, though, because, quote, this is just a scientific study, not necessarily a reflection of how people's thinking actually plays out in the real world, end quote. So, should atheists be worried or not?
Yes.
They should be worried.
They should be worried in terms of the backlash of people reading such information and saying, oh, you're bad, so you're the other, so I can really hurt you. And I think that marginalization and the otherness is a real issue, and I hate for anybody to be put in that situation.
Amy, you are agreeing there.
Yeah, I definitely agree that by putting this out there and then having that sort of disclaimer, oh, well, you know, these things don't matter, when you've compounded it by saying that, you know, they're capable of killing small animals and
yeah, that was
like
one
that.
Of the questions.
The questions. Yeah, I'm going, you know, one, how often do we know when we're walking down the street that someone's an atheist? By nature, they're not, you know, congregating as atheists.
They could be wearing a shirt that says God is dead or something.
They could be.
Yeah.
But again, this otherness that there's something wrong with somebody because they believe differently or question religion really concerns me, that this is a litmus test for goodness.
Well, as a trans man who is often seen as other, and, you know, when people put it out there that because you're trans, like with the new rhetoric, because you're trans, you must be a predator, so you must be kept out of the restroom. Because you're an atheist, you're often looked at as other, especially kids, I think, who identify, you know, young adults who identify as atheists in schools when they're in a more, you know, kind of more in the Bible Belt, like here in the South, either being seen as almost being seen as ultra liberal and like totally other if you're an atheist and you're around kids who are more, you know, Bible thumping, if you will, more of a religious nature. And every little bit that other that creates an other factor, you know, it can be dangerous. I think they should just wear an empty set shirt, though. Does not exist. So,
and you know, also, you have to be careful with some of these studies and see how the questions are actually worded,
yeah,
because some of them are distorted. But the interesting factor that I found in that study was the fact that the atheist actually kicked the atheist in there. They felt the same exact way, which I thought was bizarre. I don't know why they even said that they felt that way about atheists. So, you know.
All right, we need to hear from atheists, obviously. you know how to reach us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook or just call and tell us, are you willing to believe other atheists are bad people? Let us know your thoughts. Okay, so let's talk about a parade or a proposed parade in Portland. It was actually canceled. It was a pro-President Trump parade, but a militant left group known as Antifa threatened to assault, basically, and drag people if they were wearing a Make America Great Again hat.
The whole idea of the battlefield of ideas, freedom of speech, is it so that there is...
Antifa's statement says, quote, Nazis will not march through Portland unopposed, end quote. Who is right here? Is this Antifa going too far?
I think they're going way too far. I think we've gotten to the point now where the people who are accusing people of being fascists are actually the fascists themselves. I mean, we are in dire straits when you cannot walk down the street in a peaceful civil parade espousing any view and not be in fear of somebody knocking you out in the street just because you're wearing a certain type of clothing or you're holding a certain type of sign. That's just so anti-American.
I agree. I think they've gone too far.
Everyone's being careful here.
No, I agree. I mean, somebody can say something reprehensible and they can march in something peaceably reprehensible. you know? Yeah. And we should protect that for one another so that when it's our turn to walk peaceably and speak, you know, truth to power, whatever we need to do, that we're protected in doing the same thing. And that's what is concerning to me, is that extremes on whatever end are trying to shout down and squelch voices that we do need to hear, whether we agree with them or not.
Yes. Let's move on to something. I know everyone's reluctant to talk about that particular one, but maybe this one, because a lot of people, the majority of people say that tension in the workplace has risen since the November election. Regardless of your politics, people say it's gotten a little bit more tense. Could President Trump be to blame for why you hate your job?
I don't like my job, and I don't think I'm going to go anymore.
So you're going to quit?
Nuh-uh, not really. I'm just going to stop going.
All right. Some HR executives say employees are suffering what they call a Trump effect. Bad behavior, bullying, and swearing are on the rise in workplaces. And nearly half of all workers say their relationship with colleagues has deteriorated since the election. Have you noticed this?
Yes.
You have?
Yes, yes. I teach human resources at a college here. And my clients who are HR professionals, they talk about that day in, day out, how bullying, how the polarization in our country is taking over in the workplace as well. Mm. So having discussions about politics, et cetera, it alienates people. It makes people uncomfortable, plus all the other now okay things to do.
Mm. Amy?
It feels like, do you remember that second Ghostbusters film where there was this river of discontent and hate bubbling underneath New York City? It sort of feels like that in every corner, not even just the office place. I mean, even places that, you know, when even just like sort of public places, you can sort of see people going off into their, you know, their groups. Mm. And I feel it permeating the conversation more, and people are anxious more. And that's just not a good place for any of us to be in. And it just feels like it's bubbling under the surface everywhere.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think people want to find out where each person is that they meet and talk to. Are they with me or are they in the other camp?
Oh, that's an interesting thing, Steve. Yeah.
And, you know, I would say Trump is at the top of the wave. I think this divide started a long time ago. You had the Tea Party breakout. You've got a lot of...
Wall Street.
All this stuff. I mean, this was happening well before Trump. I think he's just at the crest of the wave.
Well, and politics is such an outside issue within schools, but it's such an inside issue, and there's so much don't ask, don't tell about politics. As an educator, you have to keep your mouth shut about your politics, but it often comes out in a lot of different ways. And, you know, having a workplace like ours where actually who you voted for really isn't our issue. It's, you know, creating this safe environment that no matter who you believe in. Yeah. But for LGBT youth, it's a big issue. There's been a lot of backlash for youth, big time, especially for LGBT youth, and creating a hostile. Yeah. And I think driving down the road, there's even more hostility because anytime you see a bumper sticker, that's the opposite.
We welcome our listeners' view on this as well as whether you've noticed those kind of changes in your workplace. You can reach us on Facebook or Twitter or just call us and leave a message. Thanks to our break room gang today, Subaya Khalifa of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta, Christian Zilovitz of Pride School Atlanta, Steve Brown of the Fayette County Board of Commissioners, and Amy Condon, of the Refinery Water. I don't want to say the name of your business right, Amy, so I'm not going to slaughter it. This is on second thought.